Coming up today, the UK government is locking horns with The Guardian over sensitive documents the newspaper was given by whistleblower Edward Snowden. A researcher has been forced to highlight a Facebook security flaw by posting a message onto Mark Zuckerberg's profile wall, and a company called Meta is working to make Google Glass cool. We'll also be discussing a study that analyses brain scan data to work out what someone is looking at, and whether digital citizens need to stop being so incensed and learn to live with the scavenging bottom dwellers of the web, trolls. All that, plus your valuable comments and feedback over the next 30 minutes. This is the wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to wearables and mind reading. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the associate editor of wired.co.uk.
I'm Katie Collins.
And I'm Kadam Shubber.
Now, everything is different this week.
It's all changed.
First of all, Nate's in Japan. Liat is off getting married, so I'm in control of the podcast reins alongside my very capable colleagues, Katie and Kadim.
Hello.
Now, Nate has visited a phenomenal new theme park in Japan that is the result of a collaboration between the BBC and Sega. He seems like he's having a ridiculously awesome time over there. But this theme park called Orbi brings together the BBC's natural history footage, so planet Earth and the like, and it brings it to life in some really extraordinary ways. There's a 40 meter wide screen that's much bigger than any other IMAX that's existed. And there are even rooms to simulate Arctic conditions, so you get a sense of what it's like to be a penguin.
That's so cool.
I am so jealous of this trip. It sounds amazing.
It really does. And the other thing they have is a kind of immersive space which vibrates that so you feel like you're in the middle of a wildebeest stampede.
So it's like the Lion King,
basically. That sounds terrifying.
You're basically in the Lion King. I mean, it sounds like Nate has had a fantastic time. He's written a wonderful feature on the topic. So just go to the website and search for Orbi. O-R-B-I, and you should be able to find it and read all about it. Now let's get cracking with the news. A huge story has erupted this week after a Guardian journalist's partner was detained at Heathrow Airport for 9 hours under anti-terror laws. Kadim.
Yes, David Miranda, who is Glenn Greenwald's partner, was stopped at Heathrow Airport, detained for 9 hours under Section 7 of the terrorism law, which means that they don't have to give you access to a lawyer, and if you refuse to answer their questions, that's a criminal offence. So he was carrying encrypted Snowden files, and all his devices were confiscated, and that's really controversial, and that's been a big controversy.
Yeah.
So then the Guardian's editor, Alan Rusbridger, wrote a comment piece about this on Monday, that was the 19th of August, and obviously saying this was a terrible thing. But in that column, there was an explosive little tidbit, which is that the UK government had pressured The Guardian into destroying hard drives containing the Snowden files. Since then, more details have been revealed. So what happened was a senior Guardian editor and another member of their team used angle grinders in a deserted Guardian basement. And they were overseen by technicians from GCHQ, which is the UK spy agency, on 20th July, and they destroyed hard drives containing the Snowden files. They were allowed to keep the debris, apparently, but GCHQ took photos to confirm that it had all been destroyed. The Guardian has been under a lot of pressure from the UK government. Essentially, senior government officials have been saying to The Guardian, and this is a quote that The Guardian, this is a quote, "You've had your fun, now we want the stuff back."
But is it stuff? This is the weird thing. I don't think these files are stuff. Like, it's not physical stuff to destroy by bashing a little bit of a computer on the floor, is it?
Exactly. And part of the reason why The Guardian didn't make as much of a fuss as it could, for example, didn't mount the legal challenge at the time and has only just revealed it, is that they said, okay, we'll destroy this one, but you do know that we have other copies. And
yeah.
They said, yes, we know that, but still destroy this one.
The Guardian have done most of their reporting on all of this out of New York anyway. Mm. New York and Brazil, so.
Yeah, so they're not subject to this law.
Yeah.
However, I did see, I heard an interesting expert on Radio 4 this morning who was saying that, you know, yes, The Guardian said, yeah, we have loads of other copies, but they did it as a precaution. Why would they necessarily believe it, saying, you know, yeah, of course we've got loads of other copies. There's no, you know, we don't care if you destroy it. So they were saying that, you know, we weren't going to take any risks, and it was only the sensible thing to do was to destroy the physical copies, which I guess kind of makes sense.
From the government's point of view, the line that they've been pushing is that, you know, this is an this is very sensitive sort of national security data, and they said that hackers could steal the files from The Guardian, so Russia or China could steal the files. The Guardian said, we don't actually have these hard drives connected to any computers, so on and so forth. And there was a great line which the government security agencies told The Guardian, if there was a plastic cup in the room where the work was being carried out, foreign agents could train a laser on it to pick up the vibrations of what was being said.
What?
Vibrations on windows could similarly be monitored remotely by laser. So, that's something that the government have told The Guardian, and it's, nobody knows if it's nonsense or not.
So, hang on. So, in a bid to kind of assuage people about the huge surveillance tactics that we have going on, they talk about this potentially terrifying technique whereby you can point a laser at a plastic object in a room and find out what people are saying.
Exactly.
Well, none of
way to
safe,
go
then.
GCHQ. But the other thing is, I mean, the Guardian seems to think that the reason why the government's clamping down is because it's kind of made a mockery of the government, whereas the government is saying no, this is about anti-terrorism.
I mean, absolutely. There are some people who are defending the government's actions and saying it is a national security issue. On the other hand, this is journalism. Newspapers have handled sensitive legal data for decades and decades and decades. The reason why the government is pushing back is because this is deeply embarrassing to them, and the revelations which are to come uncover a surveillance network that we didn't previously even know existed. So I'm definitely on the side of this is overreach, and this is unacceptable pressure that the government is placing on journalism.
Well, it sounds the whole episode sounds incredibly shady. You know, the way that The Guardian were approached by somebody claiming to be from Number 10, and it was all very sort of kind of cheesy spy movie-esque, but also terrifying in a way.
Yeah.
That, you know, all of a sudden these the kind of and also nobody knows to what extent the government knew or who'd signed off this kind of David Miranda being taken aside in the first place.
Yeah, there's been a kind of game of, I don't know what it's called, like hot potato with the responsibility. So the Number 10 said it wasn't us, and then GCHQ said it wasn't us. It's like, well, who was it then? I mean, who's running the country, yeah. guys? Yeah. Just to point out that the potential terror threat, which is what, again, this expert on Radio 4 was talking about this morning, is that by revealing the techniques that we use to monitor terrorists, terrorists have the upper hand and can therefore then learn, think of other techniques. That's a kind of argument you could have with any sort of surveillance. And it means that we can't tell you about any surveillance techniques because otherwise terrorists will find out and therefore they'll know how to avoid them.
Exactly. And what you find is whenever there are leaks which support the government, which show the great work the government has been doing to combat terrorism, nobody seems to want to prosecute those leakers.
Yeah.
And if there's leaks that embarrass the government, suddenly there's a big hoo-ha. Back to the detention of David Miranda, he's now launching legal action over the detention and trying to get his stuff back to begin with. I just wanted to quote a tweet from Louise Mensch, which was, I think, just sums up the sort of the side which thinks this is okay, but just with such... I would call it ignorance, but never mind. So Edward Snowden stole it, and thanks to our first-rate security police at London Heathrow, our security forces have it back. Well done to the police, Louise Mensch.
Yeah, you've got it back. Sure. Okay, Louise.
The reporting is going to stop.
Now. Yeah, that leak has been corked immediately. Thanks for pointing that out. Anyway, I think we've spoken enough about this topic. Katie, if I walked past your house and I saw that your window was open and I was worried for your house's security and I told you about it, you might be pleased and maybe even give me a reward. Mm. But this is not what Facebook's doing, is it?
No, it's absolutely not. I mean, Facebook, like many companies, does have a special reward scheme and a process that you can go through if you do find security flaws. It's got a specific program called White Hat, where if you're a security researcher or a hacker, you can go and report sort of potential flaws, and if it's found that they are flaws, you can be rewarded for it financially and quite handsomely as well,
and often even get given jobs at the end of it as well.
And Facebook isn't the only company that does this. There are lots of companies that do, PayPal, Google, lots of them. But in this case, this poor chap from Palestine, Khalil, He is a securities and IT expert, and he discovered a Facebook bug which allows users to potentially write on anyone's walls, whether or not they're friends with them. So he tried to contact Facebook through White Hat, and they ignored him. And then he tried to contact them again, and they sent him an email just stating, "This isn't a bug." And so he kind of felt that he had to take action, and he threatened to demonstrate this bug on Mark Zuckerberg's page. They ignored him again, so of course he went and did it. But he felt that he had no other choice because, you know, they were just... there was this really important flaw, and they weren't acknowledging it.
So hang on, what he did, he exploited this vulnerability to write a message directly to Mark Zuckerberg on his wall that's normally hidden behind a privacy kind of wall.
Yes, and you know, he was very apologetic, and he was like, "Oh, hello, Mark, I'm sorry. I feel like I've got no other choice. I don't want to do this, and I don't want to invade your privacy, but please look."
But then he took a screen grab, and that went viral.
Yes, and he posted it on his blog as well. And then moments later, his account was suspended. But the security people at Facebook got in touch with him and said, "Yes, this is a flaw. We're sorry, we suspended your account. We just didn't really know what was going on." So they reinstated it, but then refused to pay him through the program.
Why?
So their excuse was that he had violated their terms of service by not going through the correct channels.
But I thought he did.
Well, this is the thing. They're saying that he didn't explain well enough, that he didn't give enough detail.
From Facebook's point of view, when he sort of sent them an email saying, "I can do this," he didn't really provide evidence of this. And I guess Facebook get a lot of emails saying, you know, "We've covered flaws." And if they don't have sort of the proper information to act on it, I guess they might not have believed him. And then in terms of not paying him, they're sort of saying, you know, we don't pay you if you use the flaw actively, and they allow white hatters to create fake accounts so you can demonstrate it. So going back to the house analogy, it wouldn't be like seeing that your door is unlocked and then phoning you and telling you. It would be more like going into your house and putting a little note like on your pillow.
Yeah.
Saying, "By the way, your door is unlocked. You should check that out."
Yeah, I like that. I like
so
that
a bit creepy. It seems a bit unfair. It's not that he went straight for that option. He did file something through the White Hat program. Sorry,
I like White Knight better.
Yeah, but yeah, I thought that seemed a little bit unfair.
Fortunately, this is not the end of the saga, and a man, a security pro called Mark Mayfret, has started a campaign on the internet to rally round and get people to donate so that Khalil can collect his bounty.
So we're having a crowdsourced bounty in recognition of his abilities to get around a Facebook flaw.
Yeah, and it's he's doing pretty well. It's currently about 10 times the amount that you would usually get for this kind of Facebook bug. So you know. Yep.
But I do love the idea of violating terms of service as if like actual hackers care about the terms of service on Facebook. But anyway.
It is the most ironic Facebook story maybe yet, to be honest.
Well, I look forward to beating it. Now, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you will know that I have a big problem with Google Glass. I think the technology is really interesting, but that the device itself looks really dorky, and I think that's going to prevent take-up. However, a man called Meron Gribbet is trying to address this issue. His company, Meta, has a mission to create smart glasses that are stylish, cool, and non-distracting. And his aim is to make them look like Ray-Bans. So far, he's built a prototype that has a little discrete front-facing LED to tell you when you're recording, which is obviously, you don't want these glasses to be too discreet because then they kind of become like permanent spy cams. Mm-hmm. And Meta is also working on improving projection techniques so that the images are relayed into the normal field of vision. So you don't have to do that shifty eye to the right to look at the pictures, which is what Google Glass requires. And so his aim is to sort of take the stigma out of wearing these glasses. What do we think?
Well, just judging from the rendering which they had on the story and looking at the website, I don't think that they're... I definitely think it's a good idea to make Google Glass look cooler. I don't think they've made it cooler yet. I definitely don't think they've made it look like Ray-Ban.
It's a work in progress. But I mean, ideally, if you could get them to look exactly like your regular glasses or sunglasses, that would drive take up significantly.
But do you think some of the people who are currently taking it up, that kind of Silicon Valley crowd, I think they like looking like robots a little bit?
I think they do, but I don't think they appreciate that most people don't, and most people care about what they put on their face. I mean, I struggled for years trying to find glasses that I thought looked okay, and I still find them a bit embarrassing sometimes. Mm. And to then make it extra embarrassing by having like this extraordinary addition onto the side of your face, anything that draws attention to yourself, I think most people don't want that.
Well, Google has done some work trying to improve this by kind of putting Google Glass on catwalks and that kind of thing, but you know, to a certain extent that's still a kind of a commercial partnership, and just as you don't see many people walking around in the catwalk fashions every day, you won't see, I don't think, many people kind of convinced that Google Glass is necessarily a good idea. And in terms of the kind of the Ray-Ban idea, does this mean that people are going to be, if they want to use them indoors, they're going to look like sunglasses? Because I really don't enjoy it when people wear sunglasses indoors.
That's a very good point.
No, well, that's something
What do you say to that, Liv?
Well, no, that's a really good point. An MIT professor commenting on this in the story that we have about Meta said that the trouble with all these new objects is they're taking us away from presence. You know, we're distracted enough as it is. And you know, our mothers always told us to look at them when we were talking. And now, how will we know if we're not even doing the shifty eye to the right thing?
Yeah.
We could just be watching porn, potentially, or not.
I think we'd have bigger issues if you
were. If we're just trying to have a chat with mum. But yes, the dark glasses indoors might give it away. Mm. The worst ones, those specs that change colour.
Oh, no.
Between outside and inside.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. But I think this is a problem with wearable tech in general. I think the idea that, you know, you're going to put something on your person that you're going to carry around with you all the time is going to be really problematic, finding designs that will appeal to everyone.
That's why one day we'll just have it all under skin.
Google Glass might not be the essential accessory, but Google as a whole is, at least if a concerning incident that happened on the 16th of August is anything to go by. Katie?
Yes, so Google went down. There was a Google outage and web traffic dropped in this period. It was a 5-minute period and web traffic dropped by 40%,
whoa,
which is massive. And it really shows you quite the extent of Google's influence. I think, I'm not sure, there are lots of kind of statistics floating around, but I think something like 25% of all web traffic in America is Google. In North America. And this, I think, really kind of makes it sort of hit home.
Do we know why it went down?
No, and I think Google have refused to comment, as far as I know.
So it was Google, any blogger, blogs, YouTube were like, once they went down, that kind of represented a huge proportion
Google
of the
traffic. Related services.
And I guess the search traffic that's being directed towards people.
Yeah. But there was a spike immediately after when people kind of managed to get through to Google and then
binge on all the internet.
Yes.
It does feel like the beginning of the apocalypse to go to google.com and then find it's not working.
And this isn't the only outage this week. There was also an outage on amazon.com at the weekend, I think it was. And people get really crazy. They get really mad when these things go down.
As if it's their divine right.
Yes, exactly. I think, though, one of the things that I've watched a lot of outages happen and I think that it's actually worse when things like mobile networks go down.
Yeah,
I remember there was a big O2 outage last year with all the kind of data connections and everything gone.
Yeah.
And you know, people's businesses, people who were running small businesses and really needed their mobile phones, they were really suffering. Like, they really took kind of a hemorrhaging from that.
So we're about to go into an ad break voiced by the one and only Nate Langston, but when we come back, Dutch neuroscientists can tell what your eyes are seeing simply by looking at your brain activity.
Thanks, Liv. Yes, I'm not here, but I'm probably listening to an audiobook. And you can get a free one by going to audible.co.uk/wired, and it's about time we reminded you of it. Audible has 80,000 titles to choose from, and a one-month free trial costs no pounds and no pence and no yen, which is what I'm spending right now. And you can choose from any title, download it, listen for free, and if you like it, great, carry on. If you don't, that book's yours to keep and you pay nothing. But regardless, you will be supporting our show and will be very, very grateful. Pop over, have a quick look. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now, next up, we have our first segment of the show, and it's Thank You, Science. Kadim, can neuroscientists read our minds?
Maybe not quite, almost. So it's more like they can read your perceptions,
okay,
which is a weird kind of razor-thin distinction. So researchers from Radboud University Nijmegen...
I don't think that's how you pronounce it. I wouldn't hazard a guess at a better pronunciation.
Just the Netherlands. were able to reconstruct the letters that people were seeing just by looking at MRI brain scan data. They were able to do this by looking at something called the occipital lobe, which is where visual information is processed and where the neurons from your eye connect. Just a little tidbit, your eye is actually also part of your brain, just in case you didn't know that.
Okay. Is it technically part of your...
It's technically part of
what,
your...
the eyeball? The eyeball, or just the retina? Nerve.
Oh, sorry. The retina backwards.
Okay. At what point? Just
the from the retina backwards.
That's so when people remove your brain, if you were doing an autopsy, would they take the back of the eyes off as well?
No, it's more like a technical definition.
Okay, good.
Anyway, apologies. So the occipital lobe is where neurons from your eye connect, and it has a one-to-one mapping from your retina. So in a kind of rough sense, the pixels on your retina match up with what the researchers called voxels on your occipital lobe.
Okay.
And so what they did was they flashed hundreds of letters in front of people's eyes and watched how the MRI scan data changed. And they trained an algorithm to connect those changes. So crucially, they could even get it to detect letters that they hadn't trained it to see. So once you had taught the algorithm what BRAIN looked like...
And they did that, didn't they? They did the brain's letters.
Yeah, they did the brain's letters. Then they flashed up S... And then they could reconstruct that even though they hadn't trained the algorithm to look for S.
Oh, okay. Just because of the shape, they knew which parts of the...
Yeah. So why does this matter? Because, you know, why does it matter if you can reconstruct what people are looking at from their brain scan data? Because you could just look at it too and point it and say that's what you're looking at. The reason why it could be potentially interesting is because it's possible that when you think about things, the same parts of your brain that light up when you're actively perceiving something... also light up when you're thinking about that thing.
Okay.
So when you're recalling that memory,
I see.
The same part of your brain might light up as when you actually saw the thing.
That's interesting. So is that the case? Do we know about that?
That's not well known. And the researcher I spoke to was like very sort of, we do not know that exactly yet. But there was research in 2006 or 2009. Check the article, because I got it right in the article. That suggests that this might be possible, and they were able to detect patterns from the occipital lobe from memories.
Okay. This reminds me of a piece of research we discussed on a very early podcast, I think, where they showed participants 100 YouTube videos on a loop, and they monitored the brain activity as they were watching these videos. And then having done that enough times, they could then just look at the brain activity and were able to tell which videos they were looking at. And again, this was billed as like mind reading, but it sounds like it's something quite similar. It's just... we're working out how your perception works in the brain.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And also working out how you can decode that activity well, because, again, sort of hand-waving description of it, the resolution of the information from your occipital lobe isn't really good. So it's not just like a really razor-sharp letter coming up. You have to be able to... decode that data in a sort of high resolution way, which is also difficult.
Because I suppose there's so much more information when we perceive things. It's a combination of the stuff we see, the emotions we have at the time, the smells. And so it's a long way off from being able to go into someone's mind and either, you know what they're thinking directly or remember as they remember and stuff like that, which is the kind of sci-fi paradigm. Either, I think, as you said in your piece, it's whether it's dystopian or utopian sci-fi, mind reading is always in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's got to be there. I mean, what we're able to do at the moment is, for example, if you're thinking about a plant pot and then, or for example, a grizzly bear, they can look at they can look at your MRI data and sort of go, which one is it? You know, because those things are broad ideas, and they're and they're quite really different. But when you're talking about a word, when you're trying to specify that,
yeah,
like trying to think about the exact sort of sharp shapes that someone's thinking about, that's a lot more difficult. And that's what, kind of what this research is looking at.
Very interesting. So we're going to move on to our next segment today, which is, oh no, they didn't. Now, this week, we had a fantastic guest post about trolling from Jamie Bartlett, who works at the think tank Demos as their director of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media. Now, he takes an interesting view on trolling. We've obviously heard a huge amount about trolling in the last few weeks and months. But he argues that although we should be angry about recent high-profile cases, such as that of Caroline Criado-Perez and Stella Creasy, we shouldn't be surprised by it. And he explains that trolling of one type or another has been around for as long as the net. In fact, academics using the internet's forerunner, ARPANET, used to get into aggressive arguments filled with personal abuse. And so when the web then went public, so did the nastiness. He talks about early chatrooms, bulletin board systems, where flaming was born, which was a kind of nasty provocation. And the fact that when in doubt, insult was one of the 12 commandments of flaming, and that was written in 1987.
That's definitely how I use the internet.
What, you use it just to inflame and irritate other people?
No, I always feel bad whenever I'm mean about something I've read on Twitter. Or an article I've read, I always end up apologizing like two tweets later to the author.
Well, yeah. Have you ever had that when people have replied to you, you've said something mean about a story, and then the person involved in it, although you didn't mention them, finds out and then contacts you on Twitter, you immediately feel bad. There's suddenly that human connection. Mm. But yes, as explained in this piece, trolling then replaced flaming, and a lot of it started on 4chan, where for a long time now, users have raided online memorial pages. Pages and have planned something called life ruins, which is extreme trolling aimed to ruin someone's real life online. And I think this is where the cases like Hannah Smith seem to resonate. A kind of 4chan example would be to post explicit photos of a woman to her friends and family in the real world to kind of ruin their life. But, you know, in the Hannah Smith case, it was the AskFM. She was getting lots and lots of people telling her to kill herself and stuff. But in 4chan, anyone who doesn't like this sort of behaviour is declared instantly a moral fag, which is, I guess, an affectionate term amongst 4chaners. But anyway, Jamie makes loads of good points in his piece, but one stands out, and I think we kind of wanted to talk about it today. He says that, of course, the law should be used to stop things like bomb threats, rape threats, and death threats, which are already illegal offline, but that the law is completely the wrong tool when it comes to offensive, nasty, or bullying behaviour, which actually represents most of what trolling is. Mm. And then he also then goes on to say that actually we might have to accept that most of us, the kind of non-internet people, which is how we're referred to as 4chan, even though we live our lives on the internet, have joined the world of trolls and not the other way round. So although we don't have to kind of get involved in trolling, we should kind of learn to live with it a bit easier. What do we think of this?
So he's saying that we have kind of come along merrily and invaded the trolls' territory, and we've got to accept whatever goes with that.
I think we've just brought this, there's this huge kind of moral quandary that seems to be going on, this sort of huge Daily Mail shock of like, oh my God, this is happening on the internet, when it's been happening for a long time. It's been happening in people's front rooms a lot of the time, but it's now just coming to the fore that on the internet it's easy to find all of these conversations. And, you know, no one is following by the don't feed the troll rule. In fact, we are just inflaming them by giving them so much attention. You know, we would ignore these sorts of people in real life. Why are we giving them so much attention online?
I mean isn't it to do with, you know, the platform where this trolling occurs? Because no one is really invading 4chan, for example, and telling them to be quiet. It's more like when you use Twitter and someone adds you, they're in a way sort of coming into your space, and that's a notification that you receive. And when it's insulting and abusive behavior, that's not you going into their domain. They're coming into your domain and bringing that to you.
Yeah.
So I somewhat feel like if people were talking about shutting down 4chan, or people talking about cleansing 4chan, that would be, no, you don't have to go there. You don't have to see that.
Yeah.
But when people abuse others on Twitter, you can't not see it if you want to use Twitter.
And yeah.
I think that's probably what this maybe doesn't address as much, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I remember kind of one incident of trolling I experienced. It was very sort of, you know, PG compared to
what happened.
Well, basically, I wrote an article that a lot of people disagreed with, but you know, I accept that that's part of what I do. And two people were having a conversation about me. Two just people, you know, on the internet who I'd never met, sort of having a conversation about me, saying, "Oh, she's like this. She's like this. Ignore her."
Oh,
and I was like, "Oh, no. You're including me in this conversation, but you're not talking to me. But yeah. You just want me to be aware that you're talking about me." And you know, I was just, it was all very sort of, "Oh, ignore her. Don't let her hurt your feelings."
did you write to them? Did you send a message back to them going, "Hello guys, I'm here"?
No, I mean, if people have genuine questions and want to discuss things, I'm perfectly happy to talk to them about it. But you know,
so one of the things that Jamie talks about is that, you know, there's been a lot of focus on what Twitter can do to stop trolling and what other social networking sites can do, but he argues that actually, instead of trying to cut trolling out, yes, you know, whether or not we like it, whether we disagree with it, it's likely to still go on happening. We should instead equip children and adults to understand how to deal with it and understand this problem with the web. It's called the disinhibition effect, whereby people don't associate someone on the other end of of the web line, for want of a horrible analogy.
Have you just invented a new, like, the tubes?
the other end of the tubes. You don't necessarily think of them in the same way that when someone actually replies and says, "Hey, that was really mean," you don't necessarily, you kind of type things out on your computer into the ether, not necessarily thinking about the person on the other end. I mean, that's definitely not how 4chan works, but I think that seems to be the way that a lot of people online do work, until you're actually confronted with a human being saying, "That hurt my feelings."
Yeah, I think it's got to be about, you know, online communities sort of calling it out and showing people that there are real world repercussions. I love when people, you know, when someone sends abuse on Twitter and someone just gets all their details and says, "This person said this."
Yes.
I love that. And that's exactly how to deal with it. Trying to police bullying online among adults is just madness. You wouldn't do that in real life. You wouldn't arrest someone for calling someone else a rude word in a pub, for example.
Yeah.
Unless it constituted, like, as Jamie knows, a rape or a death threat or something like that.
I think it's really interesting because people have been talking about cyberbullying for years now, but they've mainly kind of associated it with young people and kind of childish behaviour and sort of playgrounds, the playground coming into the home and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, for a long time perhaps we didn't publicly acknowledge that this isn't just childish behaviour. It's not just young people that are treating each other like this, as adults as well.
Yeah, it's so easy to dismiss it as even saying, "Oh, it's just teenage boys in their room, you know, on 4chan being rude." It's not. It's a lot wider than that. But anyway, what do you think? Email us on podcast@wired.co.uk. We're really interested in hearing your thoughts. This is a topic that gets a lot of people very riled and a lot of people have a lot of strong opinions about. Now we have some feedback from our podcast number 136, where we were talking about lab meat. Now, Vlad Zeda, I don't know if I've pronounced your surname, Vlad, correctly, so I apologise if I haven't, said, "This is long dead news, but I came across another article about lab-grown beef you reported on, and my brain finally made the connection. Arthur C. Clarke's The Food of Gods. I don't mean it as a commentary, a hyperbolic criticism or anything. It's simply a good, funny and short story that you might enjoy." Now, I've had a look into this story, and it involves a world where scientists have solved world hunger by creating a machine that could turn various elements into any type of food, and people then stopped farming animals in favour of synthesised meat. However, eventually one company creates a popular tasting synthesised meat called Ambrosia Plus, and this simulates the taste of human flesh. So it's a very intriguing short story, and we think it's a great idea to go and read it, and the perfect opportunity to try out Audible. You can actually download the audiobook that short story is contained in, The Collected Stories of Arthur C. Clarke, for free if you head over to audible.co.uk/wired. And I think that's about all we have time for today. Katie, can you tell people how they can get in contact with us?
Sure, you can get in touch by following us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. We've also got a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WiredUK. Or you can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.